Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, Robin Williams with another conversation, this time with Professor Michael Soule. He's an ecologist and he's been here many times from his base in California, and he likes to compare Australia, America, as well as Hawaii with each other. Sounds a bit like apples with pears and pigs, and we'll come to that. But I'm intrigued by University of California, Santa Cruz, where you've been for some time, Michael Soule, a legendary campus in the 1960s, a place of hippie-like freedoms, peace and flowers. Was it like that for you?
I arrived there in 89, long after the roaring 60s, which I heard a lot of stories about, and there were still aftershocks of that. But actually, the year I arrived, there was a major earthquake, and there were lots of physical aftershocks. So it was different. There still was some of that same feeling. However, it keeps evolving back to the middle, which is too bad because it's nice to have extremes and institutions.
I've never been there, but some of the reputation is spectacular of the bright people who came out of such a melting pot of ideas.
Yes. I was hired to be the chair of a department which was in receivership because the faculty, though very bright, couldn't ever make decisions, and they don't like standards. They were children of the 60s, and so standards, academic standards, was not something they embraced. So I was hired to come in and shape it up, and I was, of course, greeted like a Nazi when I arrived because they knew what my job was. And I got along with most of the faculty pretty well. But I was glad to leave because I hate faculty meetings and hated them over time. So
as the rules became more entrenched and things became straightened out, and even Santa Cruz got serious.
Yes, now it's almost like any other university campus. There's many world class departments there in mathematics and astronomy and biology. So it's a great school. It was an honor to be at the University of California. I also taught at UC San Diego for 12 years before I went there.
Now, that's a spectacularly successful one. I go there almost every year.
Really?
It's got, even the security people got Nobel Prizes. It's really terribly impressive.
I quit there after 12 years to go live at a Zen center for 5 years.
How come?
I don't know.
Zen and the art of conservation.
Well, I was involved in conservation then too, but I had started Zen Buddhist meditation several years before that. In fact, I was doing it when I was here in the 70s, and my wife, who was a physician, a pediatrician, came here with me. She was not involved in meditation, but she's a very active person, very intellectual person, and was immediately bored when she got here because she was out of her element, and I was the one on sabbatical, and she was sort of on a break between her internship and residency in pediatrics. So one day she picked up one of my Zen books and started reading it, and immediately recognized that this was where she belonged. So she's even more aggressive in some ways than I am, and she became a Zen master very quickly in about a period of about 7 or 8 years. So right now she's we ended up getting divorced, but now we're very close friends.
Zen and the art of divorce.
Yes.
Do you still do it?
Yes.
Just to explain, what does it involve?
It's a spiritual path, and it's one Zen teacher said that the perfection of character is the goal of practice, Buddhist practice. Other people would answer enlightenment, but I don't know what enlightenment is. But spiritual practice can change people. It's one of the only things that I've ever seen actually change a person's character. And so if you people do it for different reasons. They want to be happy. They want to be nicer. A lot of it's about being nice and not being so crude and rude, as my natural character leads me to be.
I see. It's a good dampener effect. When you came to Australia way back in 1973, what sort of research were you doing at the time?
Well, I was at CSIRO Animal Genetics up in North Ryde, and my interest was genetic variation in populations and why populations are variable, what causes the variation among individuals. You look at human faces and everyone's different, and why? When we look at the faces of other animals, we don't recognize those differences so much, but they're there. Anyway, I was interested in why different populations of species are very different in the amount of variation within them. And it has to do with the history of the populations and how much genetic variation is in those populations. So I was here actually doing research on a reef fish that I thought might help us understand more about variation. And so I was up in Madang and up on the Great Barrier Reef collecting fish and doing protein electrophoresis on them to see how much variation was in these different populations.
That's where they spread it out and you can see what they're made of.
Yes, that's right. You spread out the proteins on a gel using an electric current and then stain them. Some populations, like it was discovered several years ago, 20 years ago, that the cheetahs in Africa were all identical, as if they were all identical twins.
Or cloned, yeah.
Yes, and that was a big mystery. That's one extreme, where a population is completely homogeneous. At the other extreme, there's a lot of difference, a lot of variation, and why?
Bananas are the same, aren't they?
Well, bananas are a crop, and they've been selected like dogs to have certain characters, like a pedigree, and that removes most of the genetic variation. That's why dogs are really stupid in general. It's because they're
Border collies are very clever. We've got border collies, and they're very bright.
They do one thing well, and that's herd people and sheep. When I was a kid, German shepherds were very bright, but since then, all the intelligence has been bred out of them so that they conform to a certain standard of what the dog breeders consider to be excellence.
Where did it lead when you've finished harvesting that sort of information in Australia?
Yeah. Ironically, I never published the results, which were interesting, but Paul did.
Paul Ehrlich.
Yes, I turned the results over to Paul, who was a friend and collaborator and my advisor in graduate school, and he was doing a summary paper on tropical ecology at the time. I said, well, you might be interested in this stuff. So he stuck it in, which was great because I didn't have time to write it up. But what I found was that this one species of damselfish is unlike all the other species of damselfish in that instead of spewing out its eggs and sperm into the ocean like a respectable damselfish, it didn't do that. It laid its eggs and took care of them like a lizard. And so it didn't have this dispersal mechanism, for the genes never got from one island to another. And I predicted, when I heard about that, that, well, each population on each island should probably be different. This is in the Great Barrier Reef and up in Madang and New Guinea, Papua New Guinea. We knew they were anatomically different, but when we looked at the genes, we found exactly the same thing, that unlike all the other damselfishes, they didn't have much variation because they were kind of inbred. And they were all very different because they were living in different environments and their genes were getting mixed up from one part of the Great Barrier Reef to another. So it was nice. But I don't know why I never got around to publishing it.
Oh, you don't have to publish everything. But, now that you're emeritus, the publishing kind of imperative is reduced. But you've just given keynote address comparing, and this is really almost an outrageous thing, comparing the biological history of Australia with Hawaii and the North American continent. Now, that's comparing apples with park benches and trucks, isn't it?
Well, yes, in a way it is, but I'm not the first to do that. Your Tim Flannery has done work like that too. But I was trying to see why conservation isn't working, why we're not able to save nature, why we're in the middle of this sixth great extinction crisis and what we can do about it. I had this hunch that the issues would be very different if we compared these three places because the histories of these land masses, the Hawaiian Islands, Australia, and North America, are very different. For example, a Uruk extinction crisis started 50,000 years ago when people first arrived in Australia. Ours started 11,000 years ago when people first arrived in North America, and the Hawaiian Islands one started about 1,000 years ago when people first arrived from Polynesia in the islands. And each time people arrive, the same thing's true in New Zealand, the large animals all go extinct within a few hundred or 1,000 years at the most, which happens everywhere, except in Africa for reasons we understand now. The cultures are different, the way people interact with government is different, the kinds of animals that dominate the systems are different. In Australia, for example, termites are really important, especially in the north. Whereas in North America, they're important as far as insurance goes, because you have to pay extra insurance to protect your house against termites. But otherwise, ecologically, they're not that important. But here they dominate, and birds and reptiles also dominate here. The largest animal in prehistory was a large Komodo dragon-like lizard, and the most dangerous animal now is the salties. Whereas in North America, it's always been mammals that dominate.
Of course, we also had the killer duck from Doom, didn't we, in the north, about 3 meters high, this gigantic thing.
Oh, yes. Each continent has had some giant, voracious birds, yes. Not so much in North America, but...
So what about Hawaii? What was dominant there?
Geese.
Geese.
Giant, flightless geese that walk around eating grass and other vegetation. But there were no herbivores that were bigger than the large geese, which some of them were a lot bigger than geese today, but they, you know, they were still geese. Just maybe 20 or 30 kilograms geese. And when Polynesians arrived at every island in the Pacific, these large flightless birds disappeared, and the same was true in the Hawaiian Islands. The impact of that is that there were never large herbivores. There were never large carnivores. There were hardly any carnivores at all. So it's a completely different ecosystem there. So the conservation challenges today in the Hawaiian Islands reflect the absence of the history of the existence of those large animals. In North America, we're very concerned with restoring large carnivores like wolves and grizzly bears, which have been wiped out because the pastoralists don't like them. Similar things are going on in Australia, but the analog to wolves and bears and large cats is there's only one analog left, and that was only introduced here 4,000 years ago. That's the dingo. Turns out the dingo is really important, ironically, for the survival of the rest of the small mammal fauna in Australia, which is mostly, a lot of it's already been exterminated, mostly by cats and foxes, which were introduced within the last few hundred years. But the only thing that really controls cats and foxes is the dingo. So the dingo turns out to be the savior, I believe, of what's left of the Australian, wonderful Australian marsupial fauna.
So we should look after them.
Absolutely. And of course, that's a bit controversial, especially in sheep grazing areas.
Yes, Chris Johnson was talking about this. Chris Johnson, who was at your conference and wrote this fabulous book on extinction and talked about it on this very, very program. But he was saying, regarding the controversy of whether people did or did not wipe out the megafauna, that if you examine which creatures died out most remarkably, they all had very slow rates of reproduction, so that you didn't have to have a massacre. All you had to do was kill a few. And because you had such a tremendous effect, if these creatures didn't reproduce for, what, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, then that would cause a slump. And
it's much easier to exterminate things if they have a low birth rate.
Yeah.
And that's true. It happens to everything that comes to Australia except people. Their birth rate goes down after a few hundred or a few thousand years because productivity of the land is low, the soil fertility is low, and it just pays off to have a lower birth rate in Australia because you can't raise so many offspring in Australia because there's just not enough food unless you're a termite.
Now, you said before that you understand why Africa was an exception. Why was it so?
There have been people, or the ancestors of people, hominids, as they're called, for 5, 10 million years in Africa. And so the animals that we have, like the elephants and the lions and all of the antelope, they evolved with people. Well, that happened on no other continent, to a lesser extent in parts of Eurasia. But people didn't even leave Africa until quite recently, a few hundred thousand years ago. Depends on what you call people. Other species, like Homo erectus, left Africa long before. But our species, Homo sapiens, didn't leave Africa until 100 or 200,000 years ago. So all these animals evolved with human hunters. And they, over time, they learned, in quotation marks, that is, they were naturally selected to cope with human hunters who could throw spears long distances or shoot arrows long distances. Whereas on all the other continents and all the other islands in the whole world, when people arrived, the animals just sort of gaped. They'd never seen anything like this two-legged naked ape. people could just walk right up to them and spear them. And the result was this havoc, this mayhem, and all the large animals in New Zealand and Australia and North and South America just disappeared as soon as humans arrived because they had no defenses, no psychological behavioral mechanisms to cope with such an intelligent, aggressive hunter.
With this sort of knowledge that we have going back vast numbers of years, plus the present understandings through genetics, as you described, of using modern techniques, how can we in, say, North America and Australia, if you can compare them, save what's left?
Well, we know how to do it. I mean, even if my scientific colleagues wouldn't like to hear this, so please don't broadcast this, but we really know enough to protect 95% of the flora and the fauna of Australia and or North America. Now, we have enough knowledge from the field of conservation biology to design a network of protected areas that would save virtually all the species. We don't have the will. People just aren't interested. Same in Australia and North America. People are more concerned with their economic well-being, bluntly, and with living their lives and watching sports and being entertained. So most of the media these days, except this program, are about entertainment, not about knowledge or wisdom.
Yeah, I saw an article the other day by somebody who does a drive show who said, yeah, well, the Bengali tiger, all very sad, but frankly, when did you last see one? And how many people on Earth ever did? And what's it matter if it disappears? They're in zoos still. Get on with it.
Yes, it's not going to affect my well-being. It's not going to affect my family's standard of living. If all the beautiful birds in Australia went extinct today, you know, we wouldn't have these cockatoos flying around and waking us up in the morning. And so, you know, we might be better off. It's a question of love. I mean, it all boils down to what we love, and we save what we love, and if we don't love it, we're going to allow it to disappear, to go extinct.
But why should I love a hairy-nosed wombat?
Well, unless you do love a hairy-nosed wombat, which I've never seen, it's really hard to answer that. Why should I love your children? Why should you care about my children? We care about what benefits us, usually materially. And if it doesn't benefit us materially, or if we don't get a lot of joy out of watching it or fishing for it or hunting it or looking through our binoculars at it, we're not going to care about it. It's not that people aren't compassionate. It's that our compassion is focused like a laser on a few things that we happen to love. Of course, our family's number one. Our religion, at least in the U.S., is usually number two. And then some friends and maybe a breed of dog, Pomeranians or Border Collies.
Border Collies, that's right.
Whatever it is. Some people like cats more than dogs, but it kind of ends there. A few people love nature. A few people, when they were children, their parents took them out bushwalking or camping, hunting or fishing, if you're an American. So unless a child has that experience and bonds with nature, say before they're 15, when they go crazy, you know how we are when we're teenagers. It's got to happen at a relatively early age. And now there's this syndrome, which is called nature deficit disorder, that, you know, children don't go outside. When I was a kid, there was no television. There were no computers. There were no whatever these machines are that you plug into your ears and listen to music. And we didn't have any of that stuff. So our parents just said, get outside, you know, and play. So that's what we did. And I grew up in San Diego and went into the canyons of San Diego. You call them gorges. And messed around with butterflies and lizards. And my folks got me a microscope, which was my television set. And I just spent hours looking through the microscope at little critters I found in ponds and things. So I got imprinted on nature and as a kid, and those fortunate people that do, then they grew up loving nature and they've gotten so much joy and solace from their experiences in nature that they naturally love it. And that problem is now that few people are allowed to experience nature or take that opportunity anymore. So I'm afraid that it's becoming harder and harder to save nature because not as high a percentage of the population loves it anymore.
But lots of people take it for granted, and they don't. I think you gave a clue in your answer on dingoes. It's not as if you're picking out one or two individual species. The point about nature is it's a network, and if you extract one of them, like people extracted the dingo, you find an awful lot of that network collapses. So what you need to do is enable a great chunk of nature to survive. And that might include all sorts of animals you've never heard of.
Yes.
And that way, the surroundings you describe, when people eventually, after a generation or so, get fed up with their gadgets and decide to go out again, it might still
yes,
be there.
Yes, by the time they do, it'll be too late. But yeah, you're right. You know, one of the first principles of religion and the first principles of ecology is everything is connected, and you don't often know what the connections are because it's so complex. But you remove one thing, like the wolf in North America or the dingo in Australia, and things fall apart. It may take 100 years to notice, but in Yellowstone National Park, when the wolf was taken out because people didn't like the wolves running around killing all those animals like elk, but 50 years later, they realized there were no more wetlands in Yellowstone National Park. Well, what does the extirpation of wolves have to do with the disappearance of this whole ecosystem, wetlands ecosystem? Well, nobody would have guessed that would happen. Also, one of the major trees in Yellowstone, the aspen, which is a critical resource for a whole lot of species that nest in it, that eat its leaves, that a lot of insects depend on it, and they're the food for birds and lots of other critters. The aspen were disappearing too. So the whole ecosystem was collapsing, and finally people figured out, well, maybe it has something to do with the fact that we removed the top predator from the system, and we're seeing this in coral reefs now. When you remove the sharks and the groupers and the other large fish, they collapse. And now we're beginning to understand those connections and realize, yes, everything really is connected to everything else. You decapitate ecosystems by removing the large predators and they fall apart. Now we know why. It's complicated, but it's one of the things that's so beautiful about nature is everything depends on everything else. And unfortunately, by the time our species, which isn't very bright, learns that, it will be too late, just like climate.
No chance?
Well, okay, I'll be honest. I usually am not so blunt because it freaks people out. But I don't think people will wake up in time. And the only condition that will create that awakening of people about what they're doing to the earth and to themselves in the long run, and not very long run anymore, is catastrophes. We only learn by making mistakes. And as individuals, we only learn from the mistakes, the interpersonal mistakes we make, really. And as a species, we only learn by making huge mistakes, like starting a war, which it turns out to be a huge error, like the Vietnam War was for America and the current war is in Iraq for the U.S. And climate change is a good example. That's a huge mistake. We know what's causing it, although it's taken a while to convince some people that it's humans that are causing climate change. And we don't have much time left. People are still complacent about it. They say, oh, yes, we should do something about it. I hope somebody else does something about it. It's called denial. We're champions of denial. So nobody really wants to take any responsibility. It's such a diffuse problem. They say, well, what good would it do for me to use less energy in my house, in my automobile? We have such an impact. I'm only 1 out of 6 billion people. Well, everybody thinks that way, and nobody's going to do anything. And governments know that. Governments know that, politicians know that to be reelected, they have to please people, which means usually providing them with the toys they want and the recreational opportunities and the economic opportunities they want. And those are all short-term things. Corporations like quarterly profits, and that's what drives the stock prices of corporations. So we're driven by these very short-term, narrow goals, and politicians know that. So that's how they make decisions, is on the basis of basically greed of individuals and greed of groups of individuals. So I don't have much hope unless there are some real catastrophes coming pretty fast, pretty soon, and then people might wake up.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Michael Soule, Professor Emeritus of Environmental Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and founder of the Society for Conservation Biology and the Wildlands Project. He now lives mainly in Colorado. And if you'd like to be cheered up after that, you can see Catalyst on ABC Television in a couple of minutes with Jonica Newby and the way they are saving the Californian condor. And there's also Paul Willis on Homework. That won't necessarily cheer you up. And next week at this time, we go to Bathurst and a wonderful new museum. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.